This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, as we continue our series on the body and mind, we focus on the mind, more specifically on memory. Many of us are plagued by memory lapses. We forget the names of people we know, forget to make important phone calls, forget what we were about to say, and can't even remember if we locked the door after leaving the house. Oops, better go back and check. Neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon says there are explanations for many of these memory lapses. He's the director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. Earlier this summer, he told Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss-Cohen that our brains are not really designed to process, store, and retrieve all the information that bombards us daily.
Our brains are not like little pocket notebooks, unfortunately. They weren't designed to handle lists of names and numbers. And they also weren't designed to juggle so many things at once or take in information from so many different channels that's competing with itself. You may be seeing something that says one thing. You may be hearing something that says another while you're even driving along doing something entirely different. And that isn't something that's very natural for us. And as a result, one of the most common complaints I hear is that people think their memory's slipping, but what they're really doing is not being able to pay attention. They're not able to capture it as it's running on by them because their brains weren't designed to grab it and hold it the way a tape recorder or VCR could.
Well, what kind of a world are our brains designed for and our memories designed for?
Well, it looks like our brains and our memories were designed for the world we inhabited about 40 to 100,000 years ago or a little bit before that time, when our anatomically modern ancestors were being formed or selected out. And as far as we can tell, that was a world of mostly hunter-gatherers. People would go out and hunt, find whatever food is near you, grab it for the day, maybe put in a little reserve, but not a lot. It was a world where probably groups of people were no more than 40 or 50. And every once in a while, you'd wander around, get together, meet up with a larger group. But you wouldn't have to remember more than 40 or 50 people well in your lifetime, because that's all you'd ever see. You'd have to remember important things like where trees were, what direction you were going in, and how to come back from a hunt and not get lost. But you certainly wouldn't have to remember your zip plus four, or your PIN, or your Social Security number, or the 1,000th person you just met at a party.
Let me ask you then to take us through the brain process that takes an event and then stores it as memory. What happens in the brain?
Well, there's really three basic processes at first to think about. One is getting it in, because not everything that runs by us and the outside world gets inside of our head. So while you think you're seeing a lot, you're not seeing everything that happens. While you think you're hearing a lot, you're not hearing everything that happens. What gets into your head is partly determined by what you want to be there and what you expect to be there. If I suddenly switch to a foreign language, not much would get inside your head, even though, of course, the sounds are still there, because you just wouldn't have any way of capturing it. And that's an important point, because people only perceive what they already know about. And people don't realize that you can't see things that you're not very familiar with, or you can't see them very well or understand them very well. So that's point number one. You have to get it in. The next step inside your head is you hold it there for a little bit. If it's sounds, you can hold them there for a couple of seconds. If it's sights, they get erased very quickly, within about a half a second, when a new sight comes in. Then you can make, in a sense, a decision. Should you keep it or should you throw it away? If you decide to keep it, you begin to burn it into the wiring of the brain. And there's a lot of processes at work there, but they all go under the term long-term memory. And what you've been doing now is converting from something immediate memory to a longer-term memory. You've been hardening it, gluing it down, cementing it. The reason you decide to keep something inside your head that way may be because you've heard it a lot, it's been repeated, or because it's important to you, so that the brain mechanism says, look, even though this has only happened once, this is awfully important, I've got to lock it in. And important to you can mean intellectually important or can mean emotionally important, so a scary episode, fear, taste, hunger, or desire, like I better learn this for the test kind of thing. Now, once you've gotten it locked inside your head, there's still another step involved in a memory, which is getting it out again.
Right.
Because very little of what we need to remember gets presented to us on a silver platter exactly the way we learned it. You know, that's part of the old trick in high school and college. You know, give the test question a little differently than they were taught it. And what that means is you've got to figure out from what you've been asked to remember the information you have in your head that might answer that question and come up with the best match. And we do those both automatically. There's an automatic search process that goes on where lots of different related thoughts light up. And there's also a conscious search process, which you know about, because you say, who did I sit next to in third grade? Let me see. It was next to Bobby. Who was, oh, that's it. And then you can go through that process mentally, and you know it's conscious. But a lot of the parts of that process are unconscious. And those three stages make up memory for us.
Most people cannot remember the first couple of years of their life and get bits and pieces, fragments of early memories going back to maybe when they're 3 or 4 or 5 years old. Is the development of memory then tied to the development of language?
Well, that particular part of it probably is. There's lots of reasons why kids can't remember. You can't remember being a kid.
Right.
One is you don't have a lot of experience. You don't have a lot of those slots I mentioned in which to put things. You know, everything's brand new, and so it's hard to remember. Secondly, it's very possible that the brain mechanisms for saving information are not very mature. Kids, of course, do have memories. Everybody who's shown a kid a Reese's peanut butter cup and then come back a little while later knows that the kid has a memory for it. But it's not as strong as it would be for an adult. They take a little longer to learn. But you hit on it, Marty. The most important thing is probably other things develop. And language is one of the most important things to develop. And memories that you have before you have language are just not saved the same way. And they get overwritten. They get crowded out by the language-based memories that come later. And all the other hopefully nice things that happen to you as you grow up, too.
Well, do scientists know why some people remember more or better or even more vividly than other people?
Well, we know why. I mean, collectively we know why, but in any individual it's hard to tell. We think that one reason why people have different memories is because their brains are different and their chemistry is different. There are so many different chemicals involved in saving memories that you and I may differ in them just like you and I may differ in whether we have blue or brown eyes or dark or blonde hair or what have you. And it may make a difference in how we save different kinds of memories in different parts of our brain. And those are probably differences we're born with. There's another difference that you and I have, which is gender.
Right.
And that probably is responsible for both intrinsic differences in the brain and also later differences in hormones that change the way we save information. And then there's finally differences in interest and culture. You and I grew up interested in different things. We were encouraged to be interested in different things. We decided to be interested in different things. And we developed different aspects of our memory. And those three reasons are probably why people differ so much in their memories, even though many people aren't aware of how different people's memories are. They are vastly different.
What can you tell us about how men and women remember differently?
Well, I can tell you a bit about how men and women remember differently, but we're not sure it's because they're men or women versus men or women in our society, which is a big difference. There's a suspicion that the real sex differences between men and women are in a kind of mechanical memory and a kind of space memory, so that men are better than women in finding their way across large distances, whereas women are better than men in finding their way around more smaller spaces, more local spaces. And that's been thought by many people to represent something biologic, coming back from the 40 to 100,000 years ago when I mentioned before, because men were asked to go out and hunt, if you like. And it may not be so hard to go out and hunt, but finding your way back again is a big problem. And if you didn't have that skill, you rapidly got culled from the tribe. Whereas women were typically the people who hunted and gathered near the village, near the settlement. And that meant you had to really know your territory very well. And it's thought that some of those differences show up in people today. However, most of the differences between men and women today seem to be not biologic, but cultural and interest.
Well, I don't know whether it's just the age of the people that I hang out with, whether it's friends or colleagues, most of them in their 40s and 50s. And a common complaint is the loss of memory, that they feel like they literally just can't remember things the way they used to when they were in their 20s and 30s. Is there a point in which the brain really just isn't working as efficiently when it comes to memory?
Well, the unfortunate news for all those who watch 30-something was that those people were already over the hill in terms of memory, or at least over the hump. But you know, among your friends, those complaints about memory may not mean that they actually have memory problems, at least coming from the brain. It is true that as we age, our mental processes get slower. And it is true that for some people in particular, our ability to form new memories gets worse. But for many people who are getting into their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, the memory problems that we complain about are not necessarily because our memories are bad, but because they're misused or abused, I should say. So think about what also happens as you move from your 20s into your 40s. Your responsibilities change. You begin to get better at certain things, and you begin to get overwhelmed, perhaps, by others. You're juggling more things. And juggling all those things is a big problem for memory. When you actually test people who are older or complaining about memory problems, you often discover that their memory strength is perfectly adequate. It's just not up to the task they've given it, which is juggling, you know, spouse, home, kids, two jobs, whatever, and trying to get some relaxation in the middle of all that.
Well, it seems as if it's the little stuff that starts to go. I used to be a fairly good speller, and now I'm watching my spelling deteriorate. I had a friend say recently that they got into a car with a colleague. They looked over at them, and they couldn't remember their name, and they work with them just about every day. I mean, this is kind of nuts and bolts stuff that seems to be slowly evaporating.
Well, unfortunately, there is a little bit of that slow evaporation. It's not as bad as we might think if you measure it objectively, but it's certainly annoying. And some of it's definitely coming from the brain. Some of it's coming because, as I said, brain connections are slowing down. So that what the name that used to pop into your head in a quarter of a second before now takes half a second or three quarters of a second, and you can see, you can feel that difference. And it means that the mechanism jams because what it expects to happen on time isn't happening on time. The problem with reading, or spelling rather, is an interesting one because when you think about it, it may also be a case of not using it and so therefore losing it, because we're really pushed in our spelling when we're younger. When we get older, we have a lot more props, and we may not push it anymore. And I don't know whether people are correcting your spelling the way they used to.
I hope not.
Maybe they don't want to mention anything to you.
That spell checker helps, too.
Well, that's part of it. Some of that may be simply because we're letting some abilities atrophy a little bit. I mean, your ability to speak a foreign language is also dropping, but you never complained about that because you may not have been using it. I don't know in that case. The problem with names is an interesting one because names are just about, the inability to remember names is just about the most common complaint that people have. But they ought to take heart in a couple of things. One is that it's almost certain that ordinary people's inability to remember names means that they actually know those names somewhere, which is, of course, people's everyday experience. They know that person. They know what their name is. The moment they hear it, they'll be able to say it. And what's going on there, we think, is actually a traffic jam. It's because you know too much. You may think you're only looking at Brian sitting in the car, but in fact, you're thinking of all the other Brians you may have heard about, okay? And as a result, your memory has a traffic jam because it turns out there's only one exit. Only one name can slip through. And so you feel this jam. You know that you can unlock the jam if you hear sometimes the first couple of letters, okay, or the first sound, or if you walk away. If you walk away and stop thinking about it, what happens is everything begins to die down. The jam begins to thin out, and the one that's supposed to come out can slip on through because it's still the most important, the most active of all. So the people tend to block on the names of people they actually know reasonably well. People that you don't know hardly at all, well, you know that why you don't know their name. And people that you know extremely well, they manage to make it through that traffic jam. It's only the people you know moderately well that you might block on.
Let's talk about an experience I know that everybody's had. We call it a deja vu, that distinct feeling that something has happened before. And it feels obviously very familiar, but there's this little voice inside your head that says, well, this couldn't be happening. What's happening with the mind, with the brain on this?
What's happening is there's two voices inside your head. There's a feeling of familiarity that happens when you see something. Your mind instantly tries to compute, is this something I've seen before? But there's also the more detailed analysis your mind makes of whether that's actually something you've seen before. Does it connect with anything else in your mind accurately? What we think is going wrong in that feeling of deja vu is that little channel, that little highway that's familiarity, is tickling you. And you get the feeling, because of similarities of what you're seeing with what you've got already stored inside your head, that it is familiar. But of course, that other little voice that's saying, no, you didn't do it, it didn't happen, you haven't been here before, that's the voice of the other channel, the channel that's making the detailed comparison. And we're built like that probably for a good reason, because in a sense, one is the emergency channel. The quick one, you've got to decide real fast if that pattern of stripes moving in the underbrush is just your cat or a bigger cat that may not like you. and that other detailed one that we've acquired later. But it does mean that every once in a while, and in fact, very frequently for people, they get this tickling feeling that's just wrong, and you have to use your reason to say no.
As part of our series on the body and the mind, we're featuring an interview with Dr. Barry Gordon, director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University. He spoke earlier this summer with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss Cohen. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Marty Moss Cohen's interview about memory with neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon.
Can memory be trusted?
Well, yes and no. It depends on, it's like asking, can you trust your children? You can trust them up to a point, but I don't know if I'd completely trust them with the family jewels or fortune, you know, but sure, a dollar now and again is fine. The problem with our memories is that it's not perfect. Nobody's memory is perfect. Our memories, unlike computer memories, were not built to be perfect. They were built to make kind of creative errors, productive, informative errors, but errors nonetheless. So when I talk to Marty on Fresh Air, there's other Martys kind of crowding at the periphery of my mind that I might be not really confusing you with, but that memory is tickling and memory may be confusing with. Unlike a computer where every Marty is distinct, has a different slot on the hard drive. Now, the other problem with our memories, though, is that we judge how good our memories are by feeling a familiarity. How familiar does this feel? And unfortunately, even if you repeat something that's not true to yourself often enough, it'll become familiar to you. So that you'll suddenly begin to think, or not suddenly, you'll think, this is real. And that's how people can convince themselves. As a result of all this, as a result of the way that memory kind of molds itself around whatever's coming in and changes what's inside the memory store and how we don't always get it out of the memory the way it came in, the notorious, you know, passing along a message from one person to another type of effect, our memories can be trusted to get the gist of things relatively well, but the details often get shredded beyond belief. They're sometimes completely invented or modified, and we may not have the slightest clue that that's not right because it feels right to us.
Is there such a thing as a photographic memory?
Well, there is such a thing as people who have fabulous memories in different areas, and there are such things as people who have memories that almost seem as though they save photographic images of what they look at. That happens more commonly in children than it does in adults, and for some reason it seems to fade as people get older, and it may be related to what we need as children versus what we need as adults, although it would be nice in our world to have a photographic memory. It turns out, though, that most of the people, if you advertise in the paper and you advertise for people with photographic or fabulous memories, most of the people who show up in response to such an ad have perfectly normal memories. But every once in a while, there's a person who either thinks of themselves as perfectly normal and they discover they have a fabulous memory, or who knows they have a fabulous memory but just hasn't been flaunting it very much, keeping it kind of as a secret weapon. And there are such people. In my book, I describe a number of those. There's a fellow who couldn't forget stories, for example. I mean, literally, he didn't try to forget them. He could remember them perfectly well, to the punctuation. Anything he read, he could remember. But there's a lesson in this, by the way, in those people with fabulous memories. They're not universally fabulous memories. People with photographic memories may have terrible memories in other areas. They may have memories that look almost as if they forgot to bring film in other areas of their life. So that the fellow who couldn't forget stories and who had a fabulous memory in other respects couldn't learn the names of people that he met very well. He was like you and me, or me at least in that respect. As he said, that's not the kind of thing I do. If I was a politician, maybe I'd do that, but I'm not, so I don't. And he was perhaps showing a combination of his own genetic endowment plus his own interest. And we're all like that. It's amazing, by the way, what kind of memory you can develop. Because one of the other lessons of people with so-called photographic memories or fabulous memories is that a lot of them are made, not born. By relentless practice, you can really, really, really improve your memory. I quoted the number of 40,000%. I'm basing that on the fact that, what, you can remember maybe four people at a party normally if you walk in. But there are known people. There are people who are known to be able to remember 400 people at once as they're introduced to them. And it can be done. However, to do that, you really have to work at it for many, many years. And most people will find that degree of memory training, like being a weightlifter, isn't really useful in their everyday lives.
Have scientists figured out whether there is a connection between having a good memory and being intelligent?
Well, the evidence is having a good memory has nothing to do with being smart. While memory is spread out throughout the brain, there's not a single box that's memory. Hmm. Being smart is different. It's using what memory you have in creative ways and anticipating and planning and everything else. And that actually has very little to do with memory. So it's very well known that there are people with fantastic memories who have only average IQs and other people who have super IQs whose memories are not very good by any standard at all.
Dr. Barry Gordon, speaking earlier this summer with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss-Cohen. He directs the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Gordon's book, Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life, will be published in paperback in October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.